From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, calling all liberals. The New Republic's Jonathan Chait wants you to reconsider your rejection of war with Iraq. Forget political posturing, forget what you might think about George Bush. Tonight on Point, one man's case for why war with Iraq and liberal principles make a match to fight for. We begin with the latest on the United Nations struggle over Iraq. Despite Bush administration concessions on a draft resolution, France and Russia continued to threaten a veto when the Security Council puts the document to a vote. I spoke today with Colm Lynch, UN reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him where negotiations on the Iraq resolution stand now.
The U.S. is still very much deadlocked in the negotiations with the French and the Russians. The French and the Russians still suspect that the U.S. has some language in the resolution that would sort of explicitly authorize U.S. military force against Iraq. They're also quite uncomfortable with some of the most intrusive new inspection reforms, essentially a series of provisions that would do things like provide armed enforcement to ensure that no-fly and no-drive zones around weapons inspections could be enforced by foreign troops. There are some other provisions about taking Iraqi scientists and their families out of the countries to conduct inspections. France and Russia very concerned about that, feel that essentially it would put the UN in a position of being involved in a sort of a U.S.-sponsored defector program. So there's some very tough negotiating still going on, but they remain pretty deadlocked at the moment.
So where are we here, Colm? France is saying we must have more compromise. Russia is effectively saying the same. Can the Bush administration further compromise and come out with a resolution that is within the realm of what it feels it must have?
Well, yeah, I think at this point what they're doing now is they have they're convinced. I mean, the senior administration officials here say they're convinced that the key countries that could block this resolution, the French, the Russians, the Chinese to a lesser degree, that they're confident that those countries are not going to veto a resolution. There's 15 members in the council. You need 9 to pass a resolution. So their plan throughout the day has been to start to approach the non-permanent members of the council, the smaller countries in the council, and try to win their support for the American resolution. So there are meetings with Mexico, Singapore, a number of other states that are not permanent members but are voting members. So they're going to try and win their hearts. And at some point, they're going to have to, if they can't reach agreement with the main veto-wielding members, they're going to have to try and push for a vote and hope they get the 9.
Now, what makes them think that they wouldn't see a veto from France or Russia, given the rather loud protest that those two countries are both making? You've reported them yourselves. Is there an effort to steamroll them? Is there a hope of doing that?
Well, I think they have probably gotten private indications from those countries that they're not thinking about veto. But also, sort of the broader issue is there is really, I mean, it seems to me that there's too much at stake for both the Russians and the French to veto a resolution. France hasn't vetoed a resolution, a U.S.-sponsored resolution, since the 1950s, since the Suez crisis. And it's just not in their DNA. They don't do it. They're all about compromise. If they veto and the U.S. decides to undertake military action on its own, France and Russia will be marginalized in whatever sort of post-Saddam Hussein Iraq is, rebuilt. And so it's a risky move for them to veto the American resolution, because they run the risk of having this taken out of the Security Council, a place where they have enormous influence, and seeing their own interest essentially marginalized in the future.
Now, when you describe it that way, Colm Lynch, it sounds as though you're saying France and Russia are protesting loudly on their way to an inevitable passage of the resolution.
It's hard to imagine that those countries are going to veto. I mean, they may abstain, but essentially this has been sort of a long, difficult, painful negotiation. It's gone on for nearly 2 months now. But essentially, the Americans, the French, the British, and everybody else, they knew what the end game was. They knew that the Americans wouldn't get explicit authorization. They would get some fuzzy, ambiguous language that would enable the Americans to say, look, we've got increased UN support for military action, and everybody else could declare that they're pure and multilateral and that they support the UN and they've never done such thing. And that's likely to be what the final agreement looks like, is something fuzzy that the Americans say builds its case for military action, and the rest of the world will say, well, we didn't quite mean that.
So if France and Russia are going to capitulate in the end, why such a struggle to the brink?
For the United States, you really want this to be a consensus agreement. The United States, you know, is perfectly prepared to go to war with Iraq with a small number of allies, with a small coalition. But the Bush administration isn't crazy about nation building. You're going to need a broad coalition of countries from all over the world. They're going to have to pitch in and sort of participate in rebuilding Iraq after a U.S. war. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be a long-term venture. And the U.S. just isn't going to want to do it on its own. And if it wants to keep the world engaged in this, if it wants the rest of the world to participate, to give money, to send peacekeepers and that sort of thing, they're going to have to do this under some sort of UN-sponsored resolution. So that's why, you know, the Americans are still doing this.
So is the resolution, as it stands, what you expect the United States will push for a vote on, or is there some further nip and tuck that Washington can do to give France and Russia a little bit more cover?
The way they have the language now, it gives them quite not explicit authorization, but certainly implicit authorization for the use of military force. It's very sort of fuzzy language, but they might be able to play with those provisions and dilute it slightly to give the Russians and the French a bit more comfort. But at this point, what we're getting down to is sort of the crunch period, and the Americans look like they, you know, they're trying to signal to the Russians and French, listen, you better come up with an agreement pretty quickly, or we're going to go and try and get the votes, and you know, we're going to stop taking your concerns into consideration, and we're going to just push our own resolution, and we'll see who gets the votes.
And it sounds as though you're feeling Washington will come out with a resolution that it will be able to interpret as a green light, if necessary, for war.
I think so. But even if they don't, what they will do is they'll sort of revert back to their original position, which before this whole thing began, which is, you know, we have the sovereign right to use force in our self-protection under Article 51 of the UN Charter. Now, the U.S. is probably the only country, maybe the Brits could be persuaded to do this, that would cite Article 51 as a justification for military action against a new another UN member, because there has been no attack against the United States, and they would basically justify it as a preemptive action. But, you know, they maintain that they have the right and the authority to do this. The rest of the world will differ, but the Americans will go ahead one way or another. So if they don't get an implicit authorizing language, they may still go along with it, because it sort of builds up the legal cover. It strengthens their position. It would be worse for them if they didn't get anything. And it also gives a certain amount of cover to the British, who have very serious internal differences over, you know, the need to gain more international support for sending their troops into Iraq. And so this would help the British.
Colm Lynch, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Colm Lynch is UN reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from New York. There's a quote. It sounds an awful lot like the White House 2002. It goes like this. Predators of the 21st century will be all the more lethal if we allow them to build arsenals of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons and the missiles to deliver them. There is no more clear example of this threat than Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And here's the catch. The messenger in this case was not George W. Bush, dread foe of the axis of evil and fool me once, fist shaker of the hawkish right. The quote belongs to Bill Clinton, former Democratic president, current anti-war peacenik. Liberals would do well to listen to what Clinton said then, says our guest tonight, the New Republic's Jonathan Chait. A war with Iraq may not only be America's best option for disarming the Iraqi dictator, he says, it also makes good liberal sense. How? We'll let him tell you that. But what do you think? Is it high time, past time, for liberals to stand up and be counted in opposition to war with Iraq? Or could it be that liberal opposition to a war on Saddam Hussein is political posturing for all the wrong reasons? The chips are down. Where do you stand? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Joining us tonight is Jonathan Chait, senior editor at The New Republic and author of an essay in that magazine this week entitled False Alarm, Why Liberals Should Support the War. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Chait.
Hi, thanks a lot.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Jonathan Chait, it might be good if you would just complete that Clinton quote for us before we have you dive into your argument. Bill Clinton said, watch out, and if the world were to allow Saddam to continue those terrible weapons, he said,
well, he will conclude that the international community has lost its will He will then conclude that he can go right on and do more and rebuild an arsenal of devastating destruction, and someday, some way, I guarantee you, he'll use the arsenal.
It does sound, for all the world, like George W. in 2002. Jonathan Chait, you're a self-described and defined liberal, and you've come out with a long essay saying, listen, liberals, this is the right war.
Maybe
George W. Bush isn't pitching it for the right reasons, but it's a right war. Make your case.
That's right. It's very easy to get sucked in by the awful arguments that George W. Bush has made for the war, which I have to confess I did originally myself. I thought these justifications make no sense whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see any reason to go to war. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that there were reasons that were utterly different than his. Look, some of the reasons are the very same ones. Iraq is a military threat. If Saddam Hussein gains hold of a nuclear weapon, he could either use it to bully and blackmail his neighbors or slip it to a terrorist and attack us or an ally without us necessarily knowing it came from him.
This is a George W. argument.
Right. That's the basic sort of George W. argument, and I think that transcends ideology. But at the same time, Bush and the conservatives have responded wrongly to liberal objections. Liberals have said, what about international law? What about the allies? What about the United Nations? Where's the precedent for this? Why are we going to war now?
Mm-hmm.
And their answers are all wrong. They're saying, we're going to war now because of September 11th. Who cares about the allies? Who cares about the United Nations? Who cares about those French cheese eaters?
So you're not a closet George W. Bush admirer here?
No, no.
It's not that you secretly like his tough guy Texas stand.
No, there's almost nothing I like about him at all. In fact, there's almost nothing he's ever done that I've approved of.
So what are the liberal pillars of a case for war with Iraq, in your mind?
Well, if you think about what are the liberal principles of foreign policy, as I try to do in my piece, I think they certainly don't get in the way of going to war, and they're probably, in many ways, an argument for war. Think about international law, for instance.
There's one.
This is a problem that a lot of liberals have, and it's a good problem to think about. Why are we going to war now? That's what you hear all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Why now? What has Iraq done now? They didn't attack us September 11th, which is certainly true.
We'll come and flesh that out. What are the other two that you've got here?
There's international law. There's humanitarianism, the idea that whatever we do in foreign policy should help the people in the country that we're acting. We can't just look up our own interests. We have to think about the interests of people of, in this case, Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also multilateralism and the need to work with our allies in the United Nations and not just go it on our own and take off the rest of the world when we do so.
Jonathan Chait, we're going to come back and dig into all these, but there are the three pillars laid out: humanitarian interests, international law, multilateralism. Jack Beatty, we're going to come back and hear it in more detail, but Jonathan Chait says, upon this, you can, in fact, he says, you must build a liberal case for war.
Well, yeah, he says the central question is, does war with Iraq promote liberal foreign policy principles? I don't think that's the central question. I think the central question is, what can the United States do to prevent another 3,000 Americans from being killed by this fundamentalist Muslim gang that's all around the world today, rampant? And what can it do to prevent the growth of that? And how would Iraq affect that? We have a war on, and his piece doesn't mention Terra's war on us. It's a little bit like Hamlet without Ophelia's boyfriend. He mentions that liberals are inconsistent. They were for Somalia and Kosovo and so on. Well, yes, there was a different context. We didn't have a war on. Someone wasn't blowing us up.
So, Jack, you're about defending the home front, and you don't think this war will do it. Jonathan Chait is saying we have a kind of moral obligation to go over and pursue this war. We're going to look at all of this. Jonathan Chait tonight is making the liberal case for war. Liberal listeners, are you tempted to come on board? Is there, in Saddam's Iraq, a liberal case for war? And if you're opposing military action, is it war that you're against, or is it George W. Bush that you're against? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is W.
Mashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with New Republic writer, essayist Jonathan Chait, senior editor there, who has an article, an essay, in this week's edition of the New Republic entitled False Alarm, Why Liberals Should Support the War. He makes the liberal case for war. And the question is, perhaps would you have rallied behind Bill Clinton for this war? And is there not a humanitarian case for liberating Iraq? Is there anything an American liberal would go to war for anymore? Or is war itself a liberal dead letter? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Chait, you must have been taking a lot of guff for this since it came out. I can imagine the circles you run in. But take us on into it. You've got these three big principles. I wish you'd unpack the humanitarian case for this war a little bit.
Sure. Liberals might tend to object to military intervention that protects our interests but is bad for the people involved. For instance, if we were to prop up some tin pot right-wing dictator, as we did from time to time during the Cold War, that might fail the liberal humanitarian test. But this certainly isn't a case like that. As everybody knows, Saddam Hussein is an extremely brutal dictator, and you hear this so many times that you tend to kind of tune it out, or maybe you have a little bit of an internal BS detector every time it goes off when you hear about these atrocities, you know, Saddam Hussein having people raped and women raped in front of their families and so forth. But it really is true. He's in league with a Stalin in terms of internal repression.
So you're saying a right-minded moral liberal cannot stand by easily and let this go on?
Well, no, I'm not saying that that's a sufficient argument for invading, because that would have been an argument for invading Iraq even before he invaded Kuwait. It would have been an argument for invading Iraq 20 years ago.
So this brings you on into the international law piece.
Right. What people tend to forget is that the Gulf War, which is a war that meets all the conditions that liberals are now setting up, it was a multilateral UN-sanctioned war, and it was in response to a direct aggression. That only ended on the condition that Iraq disarm and allow weapons inspectors into the country to verify that. If Iraq had not agreed to those conditions at the time, the war would not have ended. And in fact, subsequently, Iraq has not agreed. They had 10 years to comply, and they spent those 10 years throwing up barriers, agreeing and disagreeing, giving the international community the runaround, winning concession after concession from the UN Security Council, France and Russia, who were all too eager to end the inspections, and simply not complying and building up their weapons.
So you're saying here, you may not like the way George Bush puts it, but in fact, a liberal support of international law has to be drawn to the case for war with Iraq.
That's right. I mean, here's another great example. Liberals have been saying, who cares about international law? This is about responding to our aggression or protecting our interests. I think that's wrong. But again, I think if you think through what it means to support international law, that has to lead you towards this conclusion. Now, belatedly, Bush has started to make these kinds of arguments.
And the third pillar you stand up here is multilateralism.
Right.
I have the most difficulty reaching out and grasping this one. It seems like an awfully unilateral or ready for unilateral posture that the U.S. is in regard to this war.
Right. Well, you've got a lot of liberals saying, okay, if we were trying to work with the United Nations and work with our allies and get a UN-sanctioned coalition for war, then I'd support it. But Bush isn't trying to do that, so I can't support it. My argument is that this is completely ahistorical. If you look at the 10 years that followed the Gulf War, many of them when Clinton was president, we were trying desperately to enforce the sanctions and the weapons inspections, and the French and the Russians were undermining us at every turn, demonstrating that they, in fact, stating explicitly they had no interest whatsoever in bolstering the inspections of Iraq. So why they would suddenly be interested in doing so without some other reason to do it, no one has ever explained to me. And the reason that they may be interested in doing it is that the alternative is a unilateral American war. So the threat of a unilateral American war is the thing that's making them go along.
With as multilateralism.
Your last segment explained that's precisely what's happening at the United Nations right now.
You also put the challenge to the liberal readers, saying if you wouldn't go to war for American oil interests, why would you go to war, why would you oppose, well, French and Russian oil interests? And I've lost that argument there somehow, Jonathan, but you know what I'm talking about.
Right. Well, the point is, people have been, I think American liberals have been critical of our motives in the Middle East, but have gone a little easier on the motives of our allies. In fact, they're the ones who are being motivated by crass considerations. It's French and Russian business interests, especially oil interests, that's really making them so soft on Saddam Hussein.
And what about our Jack Beatty's first line of resistance here, which is that this is, in fact, not the war that matters to the United States right now, that we have to secure the homeland, it's the war on terror, and this is not only a distraction, but perhaps opens up a real vulnerability for the United States itself.
Well, I didn't hear him argue that it opens a vulnerability. All I heard him argue was that it's a different war, and it is a different war, but I mean, the war on terrorism doesn't require a large commitment of troops.
Jack, speak to it.
Well, yes. I mean, if you can imagine that, the problem in Iraq is the weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA last week said that Saddam was more likely to give these weapons of mass destruction to terrorists, to al-Qaeda, if we attacked or if we were about imminently to attack. So right there, you see the connection, the counterproductive connection between our attack on Saddam and al-Qaeda's possible offensive against us. Then, too, we have to imagine Tommy Franks, the American commander, as the Pasha of Mesopotamia for 5, 6, who knows how many years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can imagine that scenario playing out without it just creating all kinds of trouble for us, if not on the Arab street, then in the Arab basement, as Tom Friedman says today.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't imagine that that's going to come back on us again and again from people who are our proven enemies now, who are killing Americans now, then I think you're dreaming. And the argument that Saddam wouldn't be, that he isn't deterred, he's been deterred for a decade. And the idea that he has under no doubt that the UN and the United States would respond with overwhelming force were he to attack his neighbors or even plausibly threaten them. So he has been contained. He is contained. And I think he could be continued to be contained. These same questions were made about Stalin, in the 40s. We have to strike him first before he strikes us. And indeed, our national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, was quoted saying to a Democratic congressman recently, we should have struck
him. Wish we would have.
Yeah, we should have used nuclear weapons, whatever it took, because, of course, it would save lives in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't do that. We did deterrence and containment. It's very hard to argue with history. The Bush administration has tended, what they've done is they have conflated things. They've conflated the fact that containment and deterrence don't work against suicidal terrorists with containment and deterrence won't work against this state. They have worked against this state, and I think they would continue.
Jonathan Chait, please.
Mm-hmm. All right. First of all, Saddam has chemical weapons now. He probably has biological weapons. But as a terrific article in the New Republic several weeks ago explained, those are not currently weapons of mass destruction. The term is misleading.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever figured out a way to use those things to kill lots and lots of people. The only real weapons of mass destruction right now are nuclear weapons. And that's the worry, that when he gets them, that's when the whole calculation changes.
So use deterrence, we hear.
Well, deterrence has not worked against Saddam Hussein. To deter him is to presume that he acts rationally, and time and again he's proven he hasn't. Ken Pollack wrote a terrific op-ed in the New York Times a month ago making this point, pointing out all the times that Saddam has acted completely contrary to his own rational interests. He provoked a war with Iranian-backed Kurds, which resulted in a humiliating treaty and a loss of territory. Mm-hmm. He refused to withdraw from Kuwait, even though it was clear that we were going to invade, and he lost a great deal of his army in the process of doing so with no gain to himself.
He tried to assassinate George Bush,
the senior. He tried to assassinate George Bush, which is not a very rational move when you're dealing with, it probably would have led to a full-scale invasion had it succeeded. And then you have to wonder, is why does he want to acquire these weapons of mass destruction in the first place?
So it's obviously
costing him a lot of money.
So, Jonathan Chait, bottom line then, what is your interpretation of why liberal America seems so heavily weighted against this war, if your argument is compelling?
Well, I'd rather make the argument itself than criticize the motives. But dig in there,
because you must have thought about it, and you must have heard the feedback since the article came out.
Right. Well, I think part of it is that, as I wrote in the article, Bush has made awful arguments on behalf of the war. He's made better ones now, but initially his arguments were completely unconvincing, especially the liberals. So anyone who heard these arguments was likely to conclude, well, these must be the best arguments for the war, and I'm not buying them, therefore the war is a bad idea, which is a rational conclusion. But I don't think the right one. And naturally, it fits into a pattern of Bush having done a lot of things through his presidency. He makes dishonest and shifting arguments for a policy. He tries to sell it to the public when it's not something that we need or want. He's done this with the tax cut. He's done this with all kinds of domestic things. And I think a lot of people have sort of put the war into the same category because it seems to fit the same pattern.
But you're saying, listen, let's not get mired in the makeup. Let's look at the body beneath. And this is a war that liberals can and should stand up for. Listeners, what do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. The time is just about nigh on this war. Tell us what you're thinking. Joe's on the line from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
If a liberal were president, I might be more inclined to back the war.
That's interesting. Why?
Well, because I think that after the war was over, and presumably we won, our conduct in Iraq afterwards would be very different than an ideological and, I might say, very mean-spirited administration that we have now.
So you're saying the war might be right, but you're afraid of the Republican handling of the aftermath. What exactly about that aftermath and Republican handling of it do you fear?
I think that George Bush is motivated by oil, Caspian oil and Iraqi oil, and I think that he has no intention at all of doing anything good for the Iraqi people. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that Turkish Pasha that your guest is discussing is replaced by an Iraqi Turkish Pasha.
Jonathan Chait, pick it up. Here's a concern that that we'll get through the fight and the end will not be justifiable.
Right. Well, first of all, whatever happens in Iraq after we fight the war, the result is going to be a massive improvement for the Iraqi people. It may not be the kind of Jeffersonian democracy we want, although we could certainly try for that.
Whatever happens, let me just look at that for a moment, including regardless of casualties.
Right. Regardless of casualties, you're talking
Iraq
about
be
a
better
murderous,
off.
Extremely tyrannical regime.
So there are already casualties, you're saying, that we cannot ignore.
Look at the Soviet Union. You can say that, you know, the replacement of communism has been bungled there to some extent. But the people are clearly better off than they were under Stalin and his successors.
Well, but I wonder, Joe's suggesting they may build a fence around the oil fields and let the rest of Iraq go to hell, maybe even back to a tyrant and won't care.
I find the oil argument very unconvincing. The oil companies have been soft in Iraq. What they've wanted is to lift the sanctions and start pumping oil, which is pretty much what the French and Russian oil companies want also. So the oil industry is not a force for a tough line in Iraq and really never has been.
Joe, thanks for your call. Jack, I heard you there.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you know, the Iraqis whose life would be improved presumably don't include those who would be killed in any war. Now, I have seen recently Michael O'Hanlon did a kind of various scenarios of, you know, what might happen there. And he had estimates of, you know, from 5 to 25 to 50,000 Iraqi dead, depending upon the kind of war it was, depending upon how things went in the cities and so on. But he argued it out. So you have to subtract that from any net of good this thing could do. And when you do that, you're facing something really important here. And that's, I think, at the root of liberal objections to this war. These other things really are the manifest content. I think the latent content here is just the sense that war itself is evil.
I'm sorry, but does that mean in your mind today, because war is always surrounded by circumstances of woe and always surrounded by danger and comes with death, that there is no war that a liberal would should?
Of course not. Of course not. Any time the only time it's excusable, I think, is in cases of necessity, where there simply is no choice, where the moral situation immediately changes into one to outright self-defense. No one is obliged to commit suicide in a world of nations. That's not the situation we face in Iraq.
So necessity equals self-defense in your mind. Only self-defense constitutes necessity.
Yes.
Jonathan Chait?
Well, I certainly don't agree with that. Look at World War II. We should have gotten involved with that much earlier, before it was self-defense, before Hitler declared war on the United States. We should have upheld the provisions of the Versailles Treaty that prevented him from, you know, rearming the Rhineland and taking Austria and Czechoslovakia, things that were not acts of aggression against the United States, but clearly established him as a danger. I think most liberals, looking back in the 1930s, feel the same way.
Well, this is, I think, just this Munich historical metaphor stuff that I have had. I feel my generation has been hostage to it. We heard no end of it in Vietnam, and it played us false there, and I think it played us false here. Circumstances in the 30s were entirely different. Recently, Vice President Cheney even made the extraordinary suggestion that we should have struck the Japanese before they struck us.
Well, right, but you were establishing a general rule about warfare, and I was establishing that as an exception to that general rule. So I'm not saying – I wasn't necessarily saying the circumstances are the same, but, I mean, do you deny that I'm right about that specific instance, and isn't that a contrary to your general rule?
I'm just saying that it seems to me we've learned something, and what we've learned is that war is an evil. And you know, with all the evil people and the evil regimes, we forget about that. The Bible had it right about that. And to resort to it, you just have to have necessity. And I don't think early intervention against Hitler was on for anybody. If it could have been arranged, fine. But you can't know the future. That's the other thing. You can't know the future.
But Jack, what about Bill Clinton's argument quoted at the top of this show? What about a growing arsenal that nobody really denies of weapons of mass destruction? You made your first argument that it was self-defense that's so important. Is that implicit threat and real and growing threat, we are told, not approaching necessity at some point?
I don't believe so, perhaps at some point, but when you reach that point, you have all sorts of measures you can do short of outright war. Any place he will not inspect, you can blow it up. We can detect all kinds of tests going on. If we detect them going on, we can bomb the places. We can have a very tough sanctions policy on dual-use technology. At the same time, we can have the Powell policy of sanctions that allows medicine and food to get to the Iraqi people, eliminating one of the long-term irritants with our problem, or at least mitigating it, with the Muslim world. Mm.
Jonathan Chait, I'll let you come back to those, but let me ask you, have you, liberal, Jonathan Chait, missed a train on the liberal front, that liberals don't fight wars anymore until the sword point is at their throat?
No, that's absolutely not the liberal principle. Just look at Kosovo, where the United States under Clinton intervened to stop genocide, and I think absolutely rightly so. And I may also add that the United States did so without the sanction of the United Nations and without taking a broadly multilateral approach either.
And in fairness, there was a lot of liberal support for that.
Absolutely.
It's a thicket. We're talking tonight with Jonathan Chait, senior editor at The New Republic. New essay is entitled False Alarm, Why Liberals Should Support the War. What do you think? Is Jonathan knocking down your case for opposing the war with Iraq? Or is he betraying, is he misrepresenting the liberal cause? And what's drawing this liberal mind to this war-ready conclusion? Who's really thinking this through and who's not? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's N.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the liberal case for war with Iraq. Our guest is Jonathan Chait. He's senior editor at The New Republic, a self-defined liberal himself and no friend of George W. Bush. But his new essay is entitled False Alarm, Why Liberals Should Support the War. And he's making the case. This is the time. George Bush, in his view, may not make the right arguments for it, but the liberal argument is there to be made. Are you tempted to come on board? Is there, in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, a liberal case for war? And what would Al Gore have done? And what's this young liberal doing backing Bush's, Rumsfeld's, Cheney's war? Are you getting with the program or taking to the street? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Medfield, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I guess there are a couple points I'd like to make. I think, first of all, in some sense, the I don't agree with the premise. I think that most of the – I consider myself to be a liberal, and most liberals I know and have talked to don't per se reject the war with Iraq just out of hand, but reject one that is either unilateral or which is taken under illegal conditions. I know your guest made a case that we already have the – legal ability to go in because the war hasn't ended. But there were editorials in the New York Times over the last few months by international lawyers saying that really, if you take a look at the UN treaty mm-hmm. and the fact that it's the law of the land, we don't have the right to go in.
But you're saying if the UN would lay on hands here and all join hands around this war, you'd be on board, David?
I guess what I'm saying is that if the necessary steps are taken, if inspectors really go in, mm-hmm. and if inspectors were then unable to do their job and kicked out, I don't really believe that there would be a great outcry from liberals when people wanted to go in with troops.
Jonathan Chait, pick that up.
I think the main opposition is to the method rather than to the end.
We've got it, David, and I want to put that to Jonathan. How about it?
Right. Well, look, we spent almost 10 years with inspectors, so it's not like inspectors are a new idea that hasn't been tried. We sent them in Saddam Hussein, refused to cooperate with them. And France and Russia never cared. In fact, their response to that was to give concession after concession to Saddam and to try to dismantle the entire inspections regime. Now, what you want is for them to agree now for tough inspections. That's what I want also. But how do we get there? We get there by threatening them with the alternative of unilateral war. The alternative, no threats, obviously hasn't worked. So giving them this stark alternative is the only thing that has pushed them. And it, as your report earlier in the program indicates, it seems to be working pretty well.
So you're kind of making George Bush's case that you have to search your own soul first and decide whether this is a just war, the right war or not, and then turn to the UN.
That's right. Well, certainly the alternative case of trying to persuade the allies through sheer diplomacy to come on board multilateral war, it demonstrably did not work.
It certainly didn't until the war threat was enormous and in the air. David, thanks for your call. Nick is on the line. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. I've just been listening to the conversation for the last few minutes, and actually someone else made some of the points that I was going to make. But I've been listening to a couple of the things that your guests have said.
Are you persuaded, Nick?
No, not even remotely. Mm-hmm. It seems that he's showing a real sort of naivete about, first of all, about the history of the United States and Iraq, and also just about sort of the current U.S. administration.
In what respect?
There's a couple things that he said. First of all, he said that, you know, any intervention in Iraq would cause a massive improvement for the people in Iraq. And that, you know, recent history, I mean, all you have to do is look back to just last year when we invaded Afghanistan. And if you can make an argument that there's been a massive improvement for the people in Afghanistan, I would like
yes,
to hear
absolutely.
It. But all of the reports show that that's not, in fact, the case. And, in fact, the Northern Alliance are just as repressive as the Taliban. And in some cases, conditions are much, much worse.
I'm not sure what reports you're reading. Socially, politically, and economically, things are substantially better in Afghanistan. Now, are we doing as good of a job as we should? No, but you don't have the Taliban going around chopping off people's arms or putting homosexuals under walls and collapsing them.
That's actually, in fact, exactly what you have. And in fact, if you look at the legal policies of the new administration in Afghanistan, one of the things that they say is that we're going to change some of the policies about stoning, and instead of using these really large rocks, we're going to use smaller rocks. And
but the stadiums are closed down. We don't have the Taliban putting on formal displays of women going down in stones anymore. But we've got your point, Nick. Jonathan Chait?
I don't think that captures the broad conditions in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
I think politically, socially, and economically, things are substantially better. Now, as I wrote in my piece, the Bush administration has certainly blown the reconstruction of Afghanistan. But in Iraq, you've got a regime that, on an ongoing basis, murders and intimidates its citizens on a massive scale. Jack mentioned Iraqi casualties, which would certainly occur in a war. But how many people does Saddam Hussein murder every single year? So, you know, you certainly have to look at that on an ongoing basis. There are going to be Iraqi casualties every year.
You're saying either way. We've got it. Nick, thanks for your call. Robert's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, just to point your guess, I'm sorry, but no matter how much lipstick he tries to put on this pig, this war is being fought for four reasons. To try to distract people from the sour economy, the fact that the CEOs haven't gone to jail,
mm-hmm.
the fact that they want the Iraqi oil to buttress against Saudi Arabia's possible collapse, and for the fact that this government is being led by a bunch of soulless monsters.
Okay, all right, we hear that list, and we understand the anger that can come behind it, but what about Jonathan Chait's argument that says that may all be true, but a liberal's responsibility this time is to look through that and see that the war is still the right thing, Robert?
Lie down with dogs and you get fleas.
I don't regard
that. You cooperate with monsters, you lose a part of your soul.
Jonathan Chait?
You start to become evil.
that's not really an argument, so I don't really see any point in responding to it.
But you hear that opposition. Robert, thank you for your call. John's calling from Union Grove, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. It's good to be on.
Good to have you.
Look, the reason I'm calling is to suggest that your guest is very much in a standard American liberal tradition. I mean, Lyndon Johnson led us into Vietnam. Harry Truman led us into Korea. It is a standard liberal proposal.
Does standard mean correct? Does it mean right in your view?
There's a great American tradition of non-interventionism that is rooted much more deeply in the soil and the traditions of this country than liberalism. And it holds that, no, we don't go out and start wars just because we want to. And we as a country, we are at our best when we are dragged into wars, not, hyped into them a couple weeks before an election.
So you don't buy that we should have gone in and dealt with Hitler earlier, should have dealt with Stalin earlier, taken him out with a nuke, as Condoleezza Rice says?
Well, it's always a nice concept for a Condoleezza Rice. But let's be clear. We, as a country, we have gone to war. And it's been appropriate when we have, often. But the fact of the matter is we are a better country for not having rushed into any war.
John, we got it. Thank you for your call. Jonathan Chaita, I want to put this to you. If this war does unfold, and this weekend in Washington we're anticipating the first peace rally of some scale, do you feel that behind that your essay, its appearance, let's say, is one indicator of a kind of divided liberal soul here? Are we going to see something less than a united front?
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know a whole lot of liberals who agree with me. So I think liberals tend to be against it. Now, you've got the liberals in Congress who many of whom supported...
have voted for the resolution.
But I think some of that was for political reasons rather than out of genuine belief.
And have you had your hinder kicked all around Washington this week? Is your family outraged? Is your wife speaking to you?
My wife is only semi-persuaded. She's not totally against me. But most of my other friends are completely unpersuaded. I caught a lot of hell this last weekend.
Jonathan Chait, keep your head down. We appreciate your provoking our thoughts tonight, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Jonathan Chait is senior editor at the New Republic. Jack Beatty, come back in here. Jonathan Chait is not standing down. He says it's the right liberal thing to do.
Well, if we could indulge, if we had the luxury to indulge these liberal principles of following international law, of humanitarian intervention, and so on, perhaps we could do this. We don't have that luxury. We're in a war now. And he used, again, the example of Kosovo and so on. We had the luxury of doing whatever we wanted then. And without this context, that is the central organizing principle of our life today, how to defeat this force. And I see no argument that says that for whatever reasons, liberal, conservative, or whatever, invading Iraq or making war in Iraq will do anything other than make that prospect more difficult.
Yeah, but I do wonder how united the front will be. It will be interesting. Jack, thanks so much for being with us hour. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. One of the most closely watched Senate races this fall is taking place in Missouri. Democratic Senator Jean Carnahan was appointed to her seat for 2 years when her late husband Mel defeated now Attorney General John Ashcroft in the 2000 election. She's currently running neck and neck with former Republican Representative Jim Talent for a full 6-year term. In the first debate of her career, Monday night, Senator Carnahan stumbled through many of her answers. But Democrats put a positive spin on her performance, saying her lack of polished speaking skills will position her as the folksy alternative to Talent, a career politician. Neither candidate was spectacular Monday night, and both tended to avoid directly answering questions. Here are excerpts of the debate, beginning with a question for Jim Talent.
Last week, two Ozarks manufacturers announced that they were shutting down and sending 900 jobs overseas. I think every area of the state and every area of the country has a story like this. The U.S. Labor Department says Missouri has lost 20,000 jobs because of the NAFTA treaty. What would you do to keep American plants from moving to Mexico or overseas? And do you believe NAFTA and GATT have been good or bad for this country's workers?
Well, you've raised what may be the number one issue confronting Missouri, maybe along with health care, Robert, and that's jobs. Everywhere I go in Missouri, people are laid off or they're worried about being laid off, and it makes it kind of hollow when Alan Greenspan said, I think he said 7-8 months ago, the recession was over. He needs to get out more. Jobs are crucial because everybody who wants a good job in this country ought to be able to get one. And the second reason is jobs are crucial to prosperity, and prosperity is absolutely essential to everything else we want to do.
Mr. Talent, the question
healthcare,
was about NAFTA.
Yeah.
Can you get to NAFTA?
I promise I will get to it, Robert.
Thank
okay.
You.
Now, how do you create jobs? You cut taxes, including the death tax. You have an aggressive trade policy, and this is what you're talking about. I don't believe we can withdraw from the world trading system. I don't think that's feasible. That's where Ms. Carnahan and I differ. But we can have an aggressive trade policy where we stand up for our interests within that world trading system. Other countries do.
Gene Carnahan, 2 minutes on the same question.
We have some 138,000 people who are out of jobs right now. We have got to get in and do something about these jobs that we're losing overseas. I think it's such a shame that we have to compete with those who are earning 12 cents an hour, working 12 hours a day in abroad. And these are people that we can't compete with. These are children in some cases. And these are the people we can't compete with in this economy. We have had to keep good jobs here at home and put our people back to work again. And we've got to restore confidence in this economy. So we need to do as many things as we can to do that. And I have been part of trying to do that with getting accounting reform and pension reform. And I made it possible for those who invest or sell, I should say, if they sell their stock, they are able that they have to go through the SEC electronically. But there are a number of things we need to do. But I think that stimulating our economy here at home and not letting those jobs go abroad is certainly one of the main things that we have to do.
Charles Jaco from KMOX Radio. Charles,
do you support the establishment of individual monthly accounts to supplement Social Security? We've heard a lot about privatizing Social Security, but isn't there a way to do it in addition to the current system to keep Social Security solvent, or do you think keeping it just as it is the way to proceed?
Mr. Talent, 2 minutes.
There's two distinctions between Mrs. Carnahan and me on this issue. The first is that she has a lot of out-of-state liberal interest groups spending an awful lot of money in Missouri telling falsehoods about my record, and that's the only reason this is an issue. Because I fought my whole 8 years in the House of Representatives to protect Social Security for our senior citizens. I'll never vote to end Social Security. I'm not going to vote to privatize Social Security, which is another way of ending it. And I'm not going to vote to cut Social Security benefits. The other distinction between Ms. Carnahan and me is that I believe in protecting future retirees as well as current retirees. Ms. Carnahan, what she told the Kansas City Star when they asked her what she would do for future retirees is she thinks we need to provide more IRAs and more 401ks. You know what that is? That's privatization in its purest form.
The horse is out of the barn on this one. You have asked and pleaded for privatization, and now you're backing away from it. There's something they do in Washington. It's called Washington Speak. It's where you say one thing and do something else, or you call something privatization, and then it really isn't. And I think during your 16 years, surely you must have fallen into that trap of Washington Speak.
Excerpts from Monday night's Senate debate in Missouri between Democratic Senator Gene Carnahan and her Republican challenger, former Representative Jim Talent. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you.